This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Thanks to Resident Frequency Radio for another show playing tracks and chatting with Collingwood artists. Welcome to Living Free, a one-hour show in which we highlight one of the many programs that assist in recovery from drugs, alcohol, gambling and food addictions. Our guests share their recovery story and highlight that shared experience saves lives. You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, 855 on the AM dial, or 3CR on digital radio, or maybe even streaming on 3cr.org.au. My name's Michael, and I'm joined in the studio today by my guest, Rose. Welcome, Rose.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me.
No problem at all. Today we've asked Rose to share her experience of recovery from alcoholism with the help of Alcoholics Anonymous. But before we do that, I'd like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, traditional owners of the land from which 3CR transmits people-powered radio. We'd like to pay our respects to elders past and present and to acknowledge that the material and spiritual connection of Aboriginal people to this land was stolen from them. Now, before we start, I'd also like to remind you that Living Free Show may involve discussion of topics such as suicide, mental illness, self-harm and family violence. Please practice self-care and care of others whilst listening. That's it. Welcome, Rose. I'm really rapt that you could join me in the studio. It's always a lot more fun when we're face-to-face rather than recording it for me. So I'd like to start the show by asking the guest to tell us a little bit about their upbringing or their childhood. So what was it like growing up as Rose?
Thanks, Michael. I'm one of the rare people in Alcoholics Anonymous who had a very loving alcohol-free, supportive, environment to grow up in. And I thought that when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was just like a really good person with an alcohol problem. But actually, over the time in recovery, I've like started to realize where my alcoholism or my dis-ease with life actually started, and it actually started as a child in this very loving environment. I started manipulating situations. I was manipulating my parents. I was lying a lot. I really wanted things to be the way that I wanted them to be and not the way that the world was making them. I stole things because I didn't feel that I had what I wanted. And I remember at the age of about 8, sort of lying in my bed and just hoping that there was going to be this kind of transformation in life where my face fell off and a more beautiful face appeared. And yeah, I was a pretty young child to be this sort of controlling and this unhappy with how the world was. And I didn't really realize that until recently, that sort of turned into a disease with being in the world.
So you have siblings, so what sort of family? Big, small, medium?
Yeah, so my parents stayed together and are still together to this day.
Shocking.
And I know, isn't it amazing? I feel embarrassed sometimes when I talk about my family and Alcoholics Anonymous because, it's fairly rare. But I have two brothers and a sister, and I'm the second eldest. I grew up the eldest female, and that was a bit of a thing. Like, I was the one that cooked and cleaned and looked after my siblings, and I had a bit that responsibility. I also got to earn more money than my siblings because I did those jobs. So I was, a good business minded.
I think that stuff about alcoholism, drug addiction or whatever, it's not situational. That's, that you say, oh, it's unusual in alcoholics. A lot of people have trauma. A lot of people have a background of this, and this. But actually, the nature of the disease is that, or the illness is that it strikes at anybody, like cancer. It's not selective. It's not going, I'm only going to go and get the people come from single parents. Mm-hmm. I'm only going to go and get people who work in that particular environment or they grew up like this. That actually everybody's a candidate. I get that there's a lot of maybe there's genetics in it. I have no idea. Mm. But that's the disease is inside me, but I have this physical difference for whatever reason. I'm just born. But it's, you know, everybody's story is a little bit different.
So. Definitely, definitely. And when I picked up that first drink, it was like all of that, all of those feelings of wanting to, the world to be a different place actually like came together in feeling like, oh, finally the world is the way that it should be.
Yeah.
And that's what I didn't understand, you know. I didn't understand why those kind of feelings of restlessness and irritability and discontent as a child had anything to do with my alcoholism. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it really like alcohol from the beginning made me feel calm and like the world was the way it should be.
Spiritual experience.
Yep.
Carl Jung talks about it, you know, and I think I've listened to speakers talk about, you know, the if you go into the ghettos of the world, you find two things. You find churches and bottle shops. And that's, you know, they each give man hope. And we chose, we didn't choose it, but we found a spiritual solution to the internal problem that we had for whatever age we were. Mm. And you know, if I could just take a little bit of it, I'll take a little bit of it. How was your experience of trying to take a little bit of it? Just a little bit of that drinking or...
Well, from an early age, I started drinking when I was 14 and I was binge drinking straight away. I think the very, very first time I had a drink, I had one glass of red wine and I was so amazed by the experience that I went off to a bedroom and I found a pen and paper and I just wrote about it.
Mm.
And I think that was that spiritual experience of just feeling so complete. You know, it might be like someone taking a certain medicine that like helps them feel well. It was that kind of feeling. But then from then on, it was always binge drinking. I would start drinking and I would not stop until I found myself under a bush. You know, lots of blacking out, lots of passing out, lots of doing.
So let's talk about what a blackout is. It's a blackout, AA language there.
Yes. So just not remembering like a set of hours, you know, like I might remember sitting around in a park drinking with my friends and then I might not remember anything until I'm waking up underneath a bush.
Mm.
And that's what we call a blackout. It's not actually the act of passing out. It's the act of just not remembering what happened. And
the body's still going.
Losing time. The body's still going. I could have been doing anything, you know. And this is the thing that... you know, I remember one time in my 20s, you know, coming to work the next day and people laughing at me and saying like I was pretending to be a horse at a bar. And like I had no idea, why would I know that I was pretending to be a horse at a bar?
Mm.
Like why would I do that in the first place? But, you know, that's a blackout.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a bit of, I mean, we hear about it all the time because we're hanging out with people who drink like we drink or drank like we drank. And whereas... that wasn't my experience. I remember everything I did, which I, you know, I think that's different. I go, oh my God, I remember everything. I still cringe when I still have the heebie-jeebies when I think back on some things that I did when I drank and I think, gee, I wish I had been a blackout drinker.
I just want to mention my favourite blackout. I got up one morning, this was really later on in my drinking when I was drinking at home by myself all the time.
Social drinking.
Yeah, exactly. And I got up one morning and I came out to the living room and all of the paintings in my living room had been changed. Not just in position, but what was inside the frames had been changed.
Oh,
and cool. I had actually done that in a blackout.
Nice.
Like that's the
dedication.
Most, I know, that's the most, you know, gentle rainbows and fairies kind of blackout there is. You know, a lot of people are hoping that they didn't kill anyone the night before in a blackout, but I was changing around my decor.
Yeah, but you had a plan.
Mm.
You implemented that plan, which is quite impressive, really. Mm. Okay, so you, so when did it, like if you were binge drinking at the age of 14, when did it start to get problematic? You know, what were the consequences of drinking, binge drinking when you're 14?
Yeah, I think a couple of things. By the age of 15, I overdosed on pure morphine. Because I was starting to get to a point where the drinking wasn't taking away the feeling inside myself that was really agitated and didn't feel good. And it didn't matter how much I drank, you know, I just couldn't get to that point of not feeling that feeling. And so I started looking to drugs and to other substances to sort of try and take that away. And I overdosed when I was 15 years old, which was a very big thing for my family. You know, they weren't expecting me to sort of be in this line of, you know, drug and alcohol use and to be overdosing and in a hospital. And, you know, I started losing, I was not developing myself as a teenager. I started losing my values. I was sleeping with a lot of other people's boyfriends. I thought that that was great because it was just like giving me the kind of ego boost that I needed. But I didn't understand that actually it was against my values to be doing that kind of activity. Mm. And a lot of that stuff started happening. I was popping windows. I was, you know, like breaking into cars. I was living a fairly wild sort of existence that was very far away from the way that I'd been brought up. But as long as I was getting as trashed as possible and as drunk and high as possible, I didn't care what the consequences were.
So what happened to your friendships groups through that stuff?
We had a very unhealthy friendship group because we stayed friends through a lot of it. But, you know, there was a lot of like punching each other and not talking to each other for periods of time and not trusting each other. You know, I'm 46 years old and I'm still single and I still have issues with relationships based on how they started when I was 14 years old. Mm. So it really took me a very, very long time in my life, actually, until I found recovery to actually start realizing that I have a lot more values than I ever developed before.
Yeah, and then I guess that when we're out of control of the idea of the powerlessness over alcohol or drugs or whatever it is, or, you know, the addiction to validation or the addiction to whatever it is that I end up doing things outside my own moral code, and then I feel worse about myself, and then I need relief from that. And so I'll need to take that edge off, and then I take the edge off, and if I could control how much I take, I do it. Mm. But I can't control how much I take, and so again, I create this cycle of the fact that I'm looking for something, and I'm just to keep bending back in the same spot. I get back there.
Exactly.
So the consequences are that, well, your friendship group seemed to survive that, and so did you finish school? You finished education?
Yeah, I did. I moved out when I was 17, and I actually, you know, my alcoholism moved into its most healthiest form. For 4 years, I was with an alcoholic as a partner, and my alcoholism sort of turned into extreme codependence with him and caretaking, and I became, you know, his wife and his mother and his father's wife and mother, who was also an alcoholic. And I sort of put my own active use aside so that I could sort of be there and control the lives of these two men in my life. So I managed to finish year 12 during that time. You know, my boyfriend hinted to me that I wasn't going to finish year 12, and I decided to do it just to spite him. So I think, you know, that was a real gift, because it would have been easy living out of home as a 17-year-old not to go to school and not to finish, but I did do that, which I'm really grateful for. Our relationship broke up, and I dealt with the separation of that sort of deep codependency by starting to use drugs, and I used a lot of drugs, and I partied really, really hard for about a year. And I had that same feeling one night. I'd taken six ecstasy pills, and I just could still feel myself, and I didn't want to feel myself. And I took another one, and I was just absolutely off my face, but I just could not stop feeling that feeling inside myself. And, you know, I passed out the next day, and I was in all sorts of a mess, and I was really, really skinny. I had really bad reflux. I just wasn't coping emotionally or mentally at all. And I thought the best thing to do is leave my hometown and move to Melbourne.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I thought I would start a new life and get away from all the drugs and alcohol and everything and all the chaos. And I ended up getting in a relationship with a married man who was an alcoholic,
mm-hmm.
and taking up my alcoholism with enthusiasm. And, you know, for 3 years, sort of the drugs came back in, and I just partied and, you know, just used, and it just came back full force. And, you know, it didn't even occur to me that there was something as the common denominator with me that I hadn't found, like, friends who didn't drink like that.
Yep. You know, that's what that in AA we call it a geographical. So we move it. The problem is obviously the people I'm doing it with, or it's the job that I've got, or the relationship I'm in, or this. And so if I just change the external stuff, if I could just line the ducks up in a row, I won't need to do drugs and alcohol the way that I do drugs and alcohol. If I could just manage my life better. And the problem is obviously them. Obviously. So I'll move away from them and I'll take me with me. And then I'm left again. My experience with those geographicals is that I take me with me, but I'm lonelier because I haven't got the people around me who I used to do it with. So I've got to find a whole new bunch of people, which requires more lies and more manipulation and more selfishness and more stuff that makes me outside my moral code, that makes me feel worse. So I end up doing it worse.
Yeah.
And I go, wow. And I have no idea it's happening until much later in my life when I look back and go, oh, oops, it was me.
Yeah, well, all of that was happening in Melbourne, absolutely. And, you know, I figured out that the best solution was to move overseas. Uh-huh. So, you know, it was obviously not far enough from my hometown to Melbourne. I had to move overseas. So I went overseas and I even was living in a spiritual community. I was, like, really trying to change things around because I'd had an epiphany that if I didn't make my life for someone else, I was going to die. And I knew it was like partially a spiritual death I was talking about, but mm-hmm. also there was like, you know, I was fantasizing about doing heroin. I wanted harder, bigger drugs because I wanted to get away from this place.
Yep.
And, you know, the reality was when I stopped using and I sort of had one of these breakdowns after a big sort of near overdose or an overdose, is I'd end up sitting on the kitchen floor crying, saying to my mother, I just don't want to be here.
Mm.
And it was really that feeling of like, I do not want to be in the world. There was this like core sorrow, core grief that just, you know, and I couldn't escape it. And I moved to Europe and I started going into London and, you know, partying a bit here and taking a drug there and everything. And I got an opportunity to do some work over there that I was really, really inspired by. And I had met a group of people who I was really connected to and felt deep colleagueship with. And I just knew in myself, if I take one drink, I'm not going to be able to do this job.
Mm-hmm. So what did you do?
I stopped drinking.
Ooh.
And I didn't have a program like Alcoholics Anonymous. I just stopped drinking. I didn't know I was an alcoholic, but I kind of knew that if I have that one drink, it's going to be disaster. And I also knew that when people were drinking around me, I was really triggered.
Mm. Okay, that's a really good place to stop. We'll come back and revisit. We'll see what happens next. You're listening to Living Free on 3CR Community Radio. We would encourage our listeners to become regular donors to 3CR. By becoming a regular donor, your ongoing support ensures that we can continue to provide a platform for community issues and struggles. Jump online and go to 3cr.org.au to become a regular donor or call the station during business hours on 9419 8377. For the month of June, we have the Radiothon, which is we encourage our listeners to donate and subscribe to this particular program or the radio station as a whole to raise funds to keep the radio station going. It's, it takes a lot of money to put this on all day, every day. So, yeah, we'll have a bit more information about that coming up later in the show and also over the next few weeks. Today I'm talking to Rose about alcoholism and recovery through Alcoholics Anonymous. Before the break, you sort of talked about coming to the realization that there was a spiritual problem, like, and that you sort of, okay, hanging out with people, you made a decision that if you had that first drink, you knew it was going to be a problem, and then you were triggered by the fact that you were hanging out with people who drank, which absolutely is a difficult thing to do first up. So what happened next?
Yeah, so I decided to give up alcohol, and I remember within the first 3 months of giving up alcohol without a program like Alcoholics Anonymous, I remember lying in my bed in the dark and my room being such a mess and me just not being able to get up off my bed. And it was during the day and I'd been absolutely frantic. I'd been doing 1,000 things previous in the 3 months, and then I just could not get out of bed. I was crying all the time. I was literally losing control of the function of my life because I was so depressed and so unable to figure out what was going on with me and why I didn't have the energy to like get up and get going. And my mental health continued to decline over the next couple of years. I ended up staying sober for 4 years. But during that time, I was in and out of 2 psychiatric hospitals. One was a 7-week stay where I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder and put on a lot of medication. And I didn't really understand whether, you know, the drugs and alcohol had been masking the mental health for all this time, or whether the fact that I'd given up the drugs and alcohol was making me psychologically unwell. Like, I didn't really understand it at the time, but I just figured that I'd been using drugs and alcohol to medicate myself for, you know, 20 years, and now I didn't have that medication, and so the mental illness was coming out. I figured it was, you know, fine to start drinking again after that 4 years, because I had one glass of red wine, and then, you know, it was a couple of days before I had another glass of red wine, and that sort of went on for about 3 months, where I could really like maintain, you know, it seemed like I was drinking in a healthy way, but slowly the drinking progressed and I was drinking more and more and more. You know, my favorite day was when I would start with a glass of white wine, a second glass of white wine, and then I'd have a couple of shots of tequila, and then I'd go to the red wine, and then after maybe a bottle of red wine, I'd go to the Bailey's. And I just loved this process of, like, it was kind of like having a 3 or 4 course dinner with all of these different flavors. But I was throwing up every single night because I was on a lot of strong medication, and I was throwing up my medication. I think I went 12 years with bipolar where I wasn't really well for longer than a period of 3 months. There was a period in there where I was okay for 2 years, mostly okay for 2 years, and I was working and I was binge drinking on the weekends, but I wasn't drinking so much during the week. So it sort of felt like I was managing, and it kind of just felt like I was a heavy drinker. But drinking, because I'd started drinking when I was 14 years old, it just felt like part of life, you know, like I didn't really imagine that there was such a thing as a life without drinking.
Mm. Yeah, because when I'm sober, so uncomfortable. Hmm. Like I think I just dragged my phone out when you were speaking, and say in the book, and you know, I have no understanding of mental illness or bipolar, but I'm in the book on the book Alcoholics Anonymous on page 52. It lists the problem that we suffer from, the internal problem that we suffer from. It says, you know, I have trouble with my personal relationships. I can't control my emotional nature. I'm a prey to misery and depression. I can't make a living. I have a feeling of uselessness. I'm full of fear. I'm unhappy. I couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. And yeah. And that stuff shows up in lots of different ways, when I'm sober.
Absolutely.
Like that they call them the bedevilments in the book, and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is to solve that problem. It's not about my drinking problem, because I drink because I have that problem. And
exactly. And you know, for me, even during that 2 years where I was doing quite well and I was working and I was only binge drinking on the weekends, even though I was doing really meaningful work, my whole life was living for that weekend to have that binge drink, you know, and so I wasn't happy and living a meaningful life in between when I was sober. It was sort of like, and it had been my whole life of just waiting for that time that I can like get that substance in me. And for me, it was even that first sip of red wine. I didn't even have to be intoxicated, but that first sip was enough to like relax my whole system.
Yeah, I used to get that just knowing it was in the boot of the car.
Yeah.
Like if I could have lived off the feeling I had when it was in the boot of the car, I would never have got drunk.
Yeah.
But just the relief came from just knowing that it was going to happen.
Yeah.
Even before it happened, that it's going to be okay.
Mm.
Wow. Okay. So what happened next? What brought you to your knees? What brought you to your absolute knees, where you went, actually, I've got to live. Am I going to live? Am I going to die?
Yeah, well, I was starting to be aware of the fact that, my mental health was a real problem. I got really unwell again, and I just could not, no matter the medications they put me on, I could not maintain stability with my mental health, and it had been happening over a long period of time. I'd been really, really clear, when I was 27 years old, when I gave up the alcohol, I was really clear that I was giving up drugs, and I never picked the drugs up again, even though I picked up the alcohol. And so what would happen is I would get really drunk, and then I wouldn't have the drug to go to take me further away from that feeling. So I would start self-harming. And, I woke up one morning on the floor of my bathroom, and I had vomit on me, and I'd wet myself, and I had blood on me from self-harming, and I'd woken up there in the morning cold. And I just had this thought, I'm 42 years old. This is the kind of behavior I was doing when I was a teenager.
Mm.
Why am I still doing it?
Mm.
And I could not understand why I was in this position at this age. And I thought, I just want to be an adult. I just want to grow up and be an adult, and I don't want this stuff to happen. So that was a kind of spiritual experience, because I became very aware of the situation I was in. And then about 6 months later, things were really bad. My mental health, as I started having a hypomanic episode, I would start drinking, and I would really encourage that hypomanic episode with the alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And I would fly off into the sky with it. And then I would crash even worse than, possible. And so, I was just in a really bad place between my mental health and my drinking. And I ended up in a private psychiatric hospital. And the psychiatrist said to me, you cannot drink under any circumstances. You cannot drink. And I said, well, I don't know how to do that, because I've had a thought in my mind before, I shouldn't drink, but I had no capacity to actually stop myself from drinking.
Mm.
So even though I'd had that thought, I shouldn't drink and I should really stop drinking, I knew, well, I'm still going to drink tonight, because there's no way I'm going to do that. And, And
that's sort of the whole crux of the first step in Alcoholics Anonymous, is that I'm powerless over alcohol. It's not the dumb stuff that I do when I drink. It's the fact that I have absolutely no power to not drink.
Exactly.
That when I make a decision, knowing what the consequences are going to be, no matter how I've seen the history of how it plays out, that I don't have this power in me by myself to actually make a decision to not drink and keep that decision. And then that's the crushing thing about step one. It leaves us in this complete place of hopelessness, because I go, okay, the solution is don't drink. And they go, you don't understand. It's my whole goal. It's my whole game. The whole game plan is that it's all I do. That's what I do. So you're taking away my only thing that I know how to do. It's the nature of powerlessness.
Mm. So in his wisdom, he sent me to the rehab part of the hospital for 2 weeks. And during that 2 weeks, someone from Alcoholics Anonymous came and actually shared their experience, strength and hope. So they shared their experience before Alcoholics Anonymous and after Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I heard during that share was this idea of the cycle of addiction, where, at 10 o'clock in the morning, when I'm waking up on the floor in a really bad state from the night before, I say, I'm definitely not going to drink today. I'm absolutely not going to drink. I need to stop drinking. And then by 3 p.m., that thought comes into my head of, what about a drink? And as soon as I have that thought, I have no power over it.
Mm.
And I go down to the bottle shop and I get alcohol and I drink again. And that cycle goes day after day after day after day. And when I heard that, I realized that's me.
Mm.
And for the first time, I think right there and then I admitted I was an alcoholic.
Mm.
Because I'm middle class. I haven't lost all my friends. I haven't lost all my family. I didn't even really have a job. You know, I didn't have a partner. I didn't have kids. I didn't have a house. Like, you know, I didn't get a lot of those things in my life to lose anyway because of my drinking. And my drinking was more important to me than those things.
Yep.
But yeah, I just didn't think I could be an alcoholic.
Alcohol is identification.
Like yeah.
That one alcoholic talks to another alcoholic and I don't even know I'm an alcoholic until they tell me that their story. Like they're not sitting there talking about my drinking. They're talking about their drinking. And I go, oh my God, it's me. Hell, okay. And I'm like, it's a self-diagnosis program. I have to identify with the problem to be able to be driven to do the rest of the program.
Exactly. And it was only when I realized I was an alcoholic that I could do something about it. And it was an incredible experience. You know, when they diagnosed me with bipolar, I was so relieved because I knew, oh, now there's going to be a solution to the problem.
Yep.
And it was exactly the same. As soon as I could own that I'm an alcoholic, Alcoholics Anonymous was telling me that there is a solution for it.
Yep.
And so I felt an enormous amount of relief.
Yeah, the evidence is there. The evidence is sitting in the room with me in the meetings, and you sort of when people are sharing honestly about what it was like, what they were like, what happened and what they're like now, you know, I'm sitting there like a bobblehead with my head going up and down while they're talking about their drinking. And I go, oh, my God, I've done that. And I used to feel so lonely because I'd never talk to anybody about the way I drank because I knew it was different to everybody else's, especially the people around me. And in the end, I'm drinking by myself because there isn't anybody left to drink with. But then I get this identification when I'm nodding my head and I go, but if you drank like that and you felt like that and you thought like that and you're not like that anymore, how good is that? That's the hope that comes in when we're sitting there. So what was your experience of your first time in AA meeting?
Yeah, so the day after I got out of that psychiatric hospital, I went to my first AA meeting and I was shocked. It was in Fitzroy and everyone was cool and like dressed well and laughing and socializing.
Saturday morning, obviously.
Exactly. You know, I remember thinking, wow, I could really like make friends with these people because I didn't have any idea what to expect going to an AA meeting. Like, you know, for some reason, everyone thinks it's going to be a lot of old men. And, you know, maybe at some point in time it was that. And there are a few meetings in Melbourne that, you know, do represent that. But I was shocked. There were lots of younger people my age.
Big crew of women, like the
longer sober women.
The longer sober women. Yeah. It's like you find them, you know where to go and find them. That's where they'll be on Saturday morning.
And I didn't go by myself. I dragged my brother along with me.
Cool.
Because I was absolutely terrified.
Yep.
I was so socially anxious at the time. It took me the first year and a bit, a year and a half maybe even, to stop being socially anxious. You know, when you're newly getting sober, there's a lot of, you know, you're not really yourself.
No.
And you think that you're yourself because that's who you are at the time. But, yeah, there's a lot to let go of. And, yeah, just being around other people was absolutely terrifying for me at the time.
Yeah, there's a lot of bravado and there's a lot of I'm fine. Like it's the vulnerability that's required to stay sober is not evident when we're first sober. You know, it takes a bit of time to get vulnerable. Like I remember crying a lot at my first meetings because it's my life's miserable, but I don't want anybody to think that I'm not. It's okay, I've got it covered. So that cool. So you had a good experience at the start. We'll come back after the break and we'll play some music now, and we'll come back and we'll see what life looks like now, and.
Is drinking costing you more than money? Alcoholics Anonymous provides a free and anonymous recovery service to anyone who wants to call it quits. Join millions of other alcoholics worldwide and take your first brave steps toward a new beginning. There are thousands of AA meetings happening every week across Australia. If you'd like to find your closest meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous or have any questions regarding this tried and tested treatment for alcoholism, call 1300 AAAAA, that's 1300 22 22 22, or visit aa.org.au. This community service announcement is sponsored by Alcoholics Anonymous.
Welcome back. You're listening to Living Free on 3CR People Powered Radio. If you'd like to listen to one of our many podcasts, then you can find us on your preferred podcast platform or just search for 3CR Living Free and check out our website. As said, the Radiothon is going to be running through June, and so the show's on the 4th and the 11th and the 18th of June here will be dedicated to that. We have a budget. I'd like to thank all the people that donated last year. We had a budget last year, and thanks to the generous donations of our listeners, we achieved that budget, and I'm now going to blame you for the fact that they've raised our budget this year, and we have a higher target. So we hope that you'd feel generous. If you really like the show and you like to hear recovery stories and the hope that comes from hearing people share, you know, some of the dark parts, but also the light parts at the end, and about what life looks like now, then, you know, please dig in your pockets and or into your phones or whatever it is that where you hide your money, and give to us over sometime in June, or do it today if you wish. We would encourage you to, you know, and we would encourage our listeners to, as I said, be regular donors. But if you can donate during the Radiothon, that would be wonderful. Today I'm speaking with Rose about her recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous, we've just touched on the fact that you had an experience of coming to AA and some hope, you know, some identification you had elsewhere, but also the fact that, hell, we're normal. Like it, normal people talking about pretty deep stuff. Actually, I guess is what happens when we sort of come in with a surrender. So what happened? You know, you came to meetings. You started going to meetings regular, sort of.
Yeah. So we have a program in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's a program that works. And I didn't do the program very well for the first year. You know, going to regular and frequent meetings is a really, really important suggestion, because you get so much out of meetings and you meet people and you're part of a fellowship, and, you know, there are different topics and different themes for every meeting, and it really like allows you to break away from some of that old stuff that you're carrying from your time of using. And I was only going to one meeting a week. I was really, really grateful for the fact that I had a home group. I had a group that I had said, this is going to be my group that I'm a part of, and I'm going to do service here. So I went to that one meeting a week, but, you know, I had put down my solution, which was alcohol, but I hadn't really picked up the solution of Alcoholics Anonymous. Mm-hmm. And I ended up in and out of the psychiatric hospital about four times that year, mm-hmm. for quite long stints. So I spent a lot of time in that year. And, you know, I was still playing out old behaviours. So I entered into a relationship with a married man in the psych ward. He was married. He left his wife to be with me. And, you know, it was absolute chaos and mayhem. It's suggested in Alcoholics Anonymous that you don't get into a relationship in your first 12 months of recovery.
It's not in the book.
It's not anywhere official, but, you know, it's probably a pretty good suggestion.
If the problem is my thinking, don't rely on my thinking, is the suggestion.
Yes. So anyway, my first year was absolute chaos. You know, it was kind of back to that dry drunk period of 4 years where I gave up alcohol without having a program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was kind of that, like, my mental health just really like plummeted. But I got a sponsor after a year, and she started taking me through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the steps absolutely transformed my life. Mm-hmm. The way I see it is, you know, the process of taking the steps is a transformative process, whereby you're not the same person you were at the beginning to at the end. And I really needed that process, because the person I was had very few values, was reliant upon alcohol, was obsessing about, you know, people who had really poor mental health, who was highly, highly socially anxious, And going through these steps allowed me to let go of a lot of that stuff and really start to reorientate myself into a sober version of myself.
Mm. Yeah, deep down. So do you have a higher power in your life?
Absolutely, yes. I, you know, for me, the God question or the higher power question wasn't an issue because I grew up in a very beautiful religious environment. It wasn't dogmatic. It was very kind of spiritual rather than laws and rules of religion. So I was very willing and happy, and I've always sort of, you know, thought angels were with me and, mm-hmm. you know. But, yeah, I'm 3.5 years sober now, and I realize that my relationship to that God or that higher power, that also has to change. And I think I, you know, at the beginning I just took on a picture that I knew that was just given. And now I'm figuring out how to transform that into something that is actually real and working in my life. Because something that I've been dealing with lately is loneliness. And, you know, there's an idea that, well, you know, you don't really have to be lonely if you have your higher power or a God of your understanding with you.
Mm.
Not that it takes away all loneliness, but I just mean you have that companionship somehow. But if you don't have that relationship to your higher power, then what is your relationship to your higher power? And so that's the question I have at the moment.
Yeah, I find that I'm separated from others through fear, and fear of what they think, and fear of what the outcomes of things I do, doing things that I haven't done before, and actually my higher power is a source of courage, and so the solution to my fear is courage, and so that changes. Like, it doesn't have to be the man in the sky. It doesn't have to be anything. It's just something that gives me the courage to know that it's going to be okay. And it's only through practicing it. You know, it's a spiritual program, which is given some, you know, that people talk about the fact that the spiritual side of AA, but there's no other side. It's like the wet part of the ocean. It's, you know, that this is what it is. We're offering a program that connects us to something, to anything, and we don't have to even define what it is. We just have to say that I start to do things that you know, that I don't want to do, and then have outcomes that I can't possibly expect, because fear stops me from, you know, my great skill set is, you know, mind reading and crystal ball gazing, and I'm wrong every time, and I let it hold me back. But, you know, God gives me an opportunity, or whatever I choose to call it, it gives me an opportunity to try new things, have new experiences, and connections happen, and it's an amazing thing, because I certainly didn't come to AA for that. I came here to not drink.
Yeah, I was really confused actually at the beginning coming into AA that, you know, they were calling it a spiritual program. And I just had I couldn't understand, like, what does spirituality have to do with me drinking?
Mm.
Like, it was so just like I'd done a diploma in drug and alcohol counselling. And, you know, it just seemed so like the drugs and alcohol seemed to be one issue. And then what the hell did it have to do with the spiritual path? And what I've learned as a picture is, you know, when I look at alcohol being my solution, that's a substance that I'm taking into my body.
Mm.
And then when I give that up and I take on Alcoholics Anonymous being my solution, the solution is meetings. It's all my friends and all the people in AA that I've made. It's the meetings, I've said that. It's my sponsor. It's doing service. It's not picking up a drink. It's all of these things. But they also have a substance that comes to me, which is the solution.
Yeah,
and that for me is the spiritual part.
Mm. This connection to others is because I've separated myself from others throughout my life through my drinking and drugging. Mm. Then I start feeling connected and I can feel it. It's an inner feeling inside that keeps me, that's what keeps me sober, is this when I'm missing that connection, is I know I'm running rough or I'm feeling disconnected. We're going to have to wrap it up. I apologise that we've gone
That's
over time.
Okay.
And I'm engrossed, actually, to tell you the truth. It's all the time we've got for today. I'd like to thank Rose for coming into the 3CR studios and sharing her experience with recovery with us. thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
I'm going to have you back, so I'll talk to you about it afterwards. So I hope you'll be able to join us next week when it's me again, and I'll be interviewing someone in Gamblers Anonymous. I think it's Tom. It's not Tom. It doesn't matter who it is. It's a gambler, and he'll share his experience of recovering Gamblers Anonymous. Coming up next, we have Balam Wah, The Spirit of Wah, hosted by Uncle Talgum Choco Edwards. Join Uncle Choco in The Spirit of Wah on a journey of belonging and movement through sing-alongs and yarns. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. Stay tuned for now for more Radical Radio on 3CR and to take us.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.